Welcome to Sharecare Scotland's podcast sessions. This is podcast one, recorded on the 23rd of November 2020. And today we are speaking with Mark Bevan, who is the Chief Executive of Lukey House, the National Respite Centre based in East Lothian. Welcome to our very first podcast. I'm Dawn Williamson. I'm Chief Executive at Sharecare Scotland, and I'm also joined by Kate Hogarth, who's our Communications Manager.
Morning.
This is a new format for us. We thought this might be a different way of helping people to hear about some of the different and interesting and innovative ways that people are actually delivering short breaks and respite care across Scotland. And of course, with COVID and the pandemic, this has really forced us to rethink how we deliver short breaks. And obviously we're all very desperately keen to see services get back up and running as quickly and safely as possible. But we thought through the podcast, there's a good opportunity for us to talk to service managers, to people involved in policy and practice, just to find out how they're coping with COVID and how they're looking to adapt some of their services in order to get things back up and running just as quickly as they can. So Kate, this is our first podcast. How are you feeling about it?
Excited, a little bit nervous, but I'm sure it's going to be good. And I think it's a great way for people to find out what's going on in the context of short breaks in Scotland. So looking forward to hearing from our first guest and then from future episodes too.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm really delighted to say that our first guest is Mark Bevan, who is the Chief Executive at Lukey House. Mark, welcome. Thank you very much for being our first guest or victim, depending how you see it.
Morning, Don and Kate and everybody listening. Thank you very much.
So, Mark, you've been Chief Executive at Lukey since 2018. And before we find out a little bit more about the work at Lukey, can you just tell us a little bit about your own career path? I mean, where have you come from and how did it eventually lead you to the job that you're doing there at Lukey?
Yeah, well, I never had a plan, but looking back, it sort of seems to have made sense. So my very first job, aged 13, was working on a market stall in Manchester, where I grew up. And then I went through my training and worked in for Abellio Childcare Trust as a residential care worker, and then on to Capability Scotland, where I had principally business development roles initially through that terrible time of tendering when that first came out and the closure of the long stay hospitals and all of that, and then became involved in managing some of those services and ended up as the director of services at Capability Scotland after a while. And that got me interested in public policy and legislation, because through legislation you can affect many more people's lives than you can just by delivering a service, really important though that is. And I ended up working for Amnesty International as a country director, very interested in human rights policy and legislative work there. I moved from there to work for a charity led by the Prince of Wales, Responsible Business Network, and I led that in Scotland and did a couple of other things. And we're starting to get to that stage in my life where I was thinking about why am I doing this? The children were starting to grow up, thinking about reassessing what mattered to me. And I went to see a recruitment agent and we talked about the things that were important. And within a couple of months, the role at Lukey House came up and it ticked all the boxes. And I knew Lukey well because I've lived in North Berwick. I was neighbour to my predecessor, Mary O'Keefe, for 17 years. So as you say, I've been here for 2 years and it all seems to make sense when I look backwards, but there was never a plan.
For those people who are perhaps less familiar with Lukey, can you just tell us a little bit, firstly, about where you're located? And I think just tell us a little bit about the history of Lukey House as well.
Yep, we're about a mile outside of North Berwick with fantastic views towards the town and North Berwick Law. And we're based in an 18th century house, which is built on the remains of much, much older buildings. And the house is called Lukey House and always has been, but the reason why has been lost in history. And it's the ancestral seat of the Dalrymple family, who've been baronets in this region since 1664. The first born male heir, called Hugh, for the last 400 years, is currently our landlord. He grew up here very briefly, and then his father moved out of the big house in about 1960 and offered it to 40 charities. asking if they could make good use of it. And he didn't get one reply. And it was a deeply religious family, the Dalrymples, and they then offered the house to Servite nuns who moved in. And the nuns, after a short while, started to offer respite breaks here, so from the mid-60s. And we have a legacy of that today, in that every second weekend, the house closes up on a Friday afternoon, and everybody takes a break and, you know, recharges the batteries and starts again on a Monday morning, which is a legacy from the nuns, because they had a spiritual retreat once a fortnight. And, you know, that remains every bit as important today for the staff who work here, whether they're religious or not, that opportunity just to switch off, relax, reflect, and then back in on a Monday morning when the guests come, they put their glad rags on and the energy's there for them to work well with our guests.
I love that you've still got that connection to the history just through the building, but also through the weekend break. I think that's such a lovely thing just to continue that. Can you tell us a bit more about the people that come to Lukey as your guests and what Lukey can offer them and their families?
Yeah, well, latterly, Lukey was run by the MS Society, and it offered short breaks to people with multiple sclerosis. And that's what we do today. For the last 10 years, we've been an independent charity offering short breaks to people with MS and other neurological conditions. And if we stick with MS for now, typically the age of diagnosis is in the mid-40s. So if we can think about probably having young family, mortgage to the hilt, forging on with career, busy, busy, busy lives. And then suddenly you get this diagnosis that starts to make sense of a range of conditions you have. And really quite quickly, people can start to lose control of their limbs, legs first usually. So most of the people who come to Lukey use a wheelchair to get around. And the disease is well managed by medicine. Now people live very full, rich and long lives, but it is physically debilitating. And one of the impacts of that is that people's loved ones become their physical carers. And that's demanding, it's a huge responsibility, and it's exhausting. And what the staff at Lukey offer is a wee break for those carers in the lovely house that we've all just described. And it's really important that it is a lovely house and that our staff do have the energy on that Monday morning, because it's very, very hard to say, actually, I'm struggling to cope and I need my husband and wife to go away for a week or so while we have a bit of a break. But if they know that when their husband or wife or son or daughter is coming to Lukey, they're going to have at least as good a time as they're having, it makes that so much easier. It's a much more positive thing. And unfortunately, we can only offer that to about 300 people a year because of the size of the place. So we'll maybe have 15 people at any one time, each in their own very nice bedroom with nice bathrooms and all the rest of it. And we try and run the place like a country hotel. And all the institutional stuff, the technology and the nursing and the physiotherapy that we have on site is all in the background and available to help our guests to have the very best time they possibly can.
So everything was going pretty well start of this year. Maybe we'd heard on the news that this kind of strange virus in China, and then suddenly in March, everything changed completely and the world was turned upside down. What impact did this have on Lukey and the staff and the guests that you had lined up for the remainder of the year?
Well, the immediate effect was to cause us to consider the extent that which we could look after the health of the guests who were with us. And in the end of the first week in March, we thought we knew enough about the way the virus was going to know that the guests that we have were going to be particularly vulnerable. Being in close physical proximity to one another and the staff team was going to be dangerous for everybody concerned. And that our staff team were no less vulnerable, really, than the guests in terms of their ability to catch and certainly pass on the virus. So those were the three things that we felt fairly sure about. And that actually made it quite easy to say, well, we can't continue to deliver the service, even though we know how valuable it is. And within a couple of days, we had a conversation with all the guests who were with us and their carers. And we made arrangements over the course of 7 or 8 days to return everybody home, and spoke to all of the guests who were due to come for the following 6 months, because we figured that was our planning horizon. Little did we know. to say that we didn't think it was safe to offer the service to them. And that was heartbreaking, you know, because we know how important the break is and we enjoy it and the staff team enjoy it. But if we can't meet the fundamentals of keeping guests safe and ensuring that we have enough staff to look after them when they're here, then we can't deliver a service. So we had that very difficult decision to make and to communicate to everybody, and there are a wide range of stakeholders here. And I suppose that was the first and early lesson from COVID. We had to make decisions which had a strategic impact in a tactical timeframe. And they were really big decisions made in the absence of really good knowledge. And that's what we did. We sent everybody home, and that immediately left us. I mean, the Friday that everybody had gone, we were sort of floating about the place wondering what the hell we were going to do. And this sort of deficit of purpose is how I've described it, because it's a very purposeful organization. Everybody who works here believes in what we do and they think it's really important and it matters to them personally. We get a lot of satisfaction out of what we do here. And there was a big gap there. There was also a huge gap in terms of funding. And we had a major panic about what the organization was going to do, because we receive £2 million a year to provide the service that we provide at Lukey. And half of that we have to fundraise. Now, clearly there was no going to be fundraising activity. We had to decide what to do with the organization. And we knew that we had really good staff, but we weren't sure how long we would have them because of the disease, and that we have really excellent resources here. So we reached out to our wider network. And I suppose the second lesson from COVID for me was government was brilliant at reacting fast and making blanket policy, kind of like we had done at Lukey. But it really needed the advice of agencies that were delivering services on the ground in order to make refined decisions. So we were left without a purpose, without an income, without a guest group, with none of our usual connections who are very good at what they do being able to give us any advice. And we had to come up with some planning principles, really, because there wasn't good quality knowledge. And our principles were around, this was really serious and it wouldn't last forever, but we didn't know how long. We did think about 6 months. That the most important thing was to try and keep hold of all of the staff, because when we were able to return to provide the service, if we had all the staff still with us, we could pretty much turn that tap back on. If we didn't, it takes about 4 months from working out that you need someone to having them being able to deliver on the ground as you need it. And frankly, the organization owed it to the team. They're a hugely dedicated law group of people who work here, and they are what Lukey is. You know, the house is special and important, but we could operate in a different building, but we couldn't operate with different people. And the board came together. We formed a subgroup so that we could make these strategic decisions very quickly. And that group met weekly. And within a couple of weeks, we'd made an arrangement with NHS Scotland to provide what they call a step down service. So if you remember back to, so this was the 28th of March, this decision was made. And at that time, the NHS was in a panic about having enough beds for the tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people that they expected to be hospitalized, and touch wood, thankfully that never came to pass. But in order to prepare for that, the NHS started to ask other places to look after people who needed healthcare but didn't necessarily need to be in hospital. And we were able to offer that service with some caveats around being able to offer it for as long as we had staff available to do it. And thankfully, things didn't get as bad as we thought they might. So for most of the summer, we cared for people who had previously been in hospital, people who were generally quite poorly, unwell, mostly in their beds. It was a very different sort of service. It wasn't the lively, noisy place full of banter that we usually have. And that's what we did most immediately. We then started to ring round the people who we would normally support, the carers and their guests. And over time, those stories became more and more troubling. And we started off with some fairly trivial stuff. We ran quizzes and set up an online book club, and then we were very fortunate, got some funding to help us, to help guests and carers to get online so that it could access goods and services, which were moving online at a great pace, but much faster than the majority of our carers' skills and abilities to take advantage of online services. So we were fortunate in getting the funding and we were able to help people with all of that. And then we started to hear from carers and from our guests and from healthcare providers in localities that carers were really starting to struggle. They were exhausted as care in the community had started to fall away. So that workforce became diminished very, very quickly. Carers, understandably, paid carers were anxious about catching and passing on the virus. They were being moved to higher tariff, more emergency services. And there was this huge deficit. So despite government acknowledging that there was a right to an assessment for respite care and indeed care itself, it started to fall away pretty fast. And we heard stories of people getting bed sores, people being admitted to hospital with exhaustion, and began to wonder what we may be able to do. And then we had lengthy and protracted conversations with our supporters in the Care Inspectorate, the local health and social care partnership, who were fantastic in their organisation, clinicians, policymakers in Scottish Government, trying to sew together the different pieces of advice that might enable us to provide some emergency respite care. Because frankly, for some people, the concerns about COVID were being overshadowed by the actual experience of exhaustion and care on a day-to-day basis. And I suppose that was another lesson for us. There were a number of people in positions of administration and positions of knowledge who only saw a bit of the picture. And because we had this relationship with the guests that has been developed over many, many years, and we knew the carers really, really well, we could see the whole of their story. And we ended up being in this privileged position of being able to tell the story in the round to clinicians, social workers, and administrators in the civil service. But it was enormously difficult for politicians to enable respite to happen again, because care homes were in such a media spotlight. And there's no doubt there were very real risks. That's why we had taken the decision to close in the first place. And the media had care homes in the spotlight all the time. And we've returned to that again in the last month around visiting. So I had a lot of sympathy with politicians who needed to make the decision about whether or not to enable respite care to take place. However, because of the powerful testimonies that carers and guests were able to tell us, and because of the relationships we built with professionals in the community, we were, along with others, able to persuade the Cabinet Secretary that under certain circumstances, respite could be provided, because the blanket policy of saying no respite was doing more harm than good to a large number of people. And so on the 28th of September, we opened our doors again for what we called COVID secure respite. And it's a very different experience. We are going around the place in face masks, with PPE, with hand washing all of the time, with socially distanced meal times, and you know all of that stuff that I'm sure many others who are listening to this are doing as well. But it does mean some carers are getting a break.
I'm really interested how the phrase that you used at the start, this deficit of purpose, I'm sure many people can really relate to that, but then how clear your purpose became as the situation emerged about this, having this holistic view of things and the need for respite and that influence that you could have in kind of advocating for carers and people with care needs for respite to start again. Was there anything else that you felt that you had to take into consideration? How did you consult with your guests about what they wanted, and with carers? Was that something that you really had to spend a lot of time doing? Because I know that in some cases it's carer confidence is being a bit of a barrier to people reaccessing services.
Sure. We spent a lot of time thinking about and undertaking communication with carers and guests. So we were in touch with our, if I could call it, carer and guest community on a fortnightly basis, at least. We made really good use of Facebook to tell our community of interest what we were thinking and what we thought the latest was and the direction of travel. Because we'd worked very closely with clinicians in the Health and Social Care Partnership and with the Care Inspectorate, our regulator, and we'd invited them in to help us put in place COVID risk prevention measures, we felt pretty confident that we had done everything that could be done and we'd taken all the advice that we could take. And we laid that out for the guests. So we ran a couple of focus groups, we did many Zoom meetings, and we wrote to people, and we started to build a list of folk who, for them, as I said before, the risks of COVID were fewer or lower down their priority list, perhaps, than their acknowledged risk of continuing to provide care in very difficult circumstances. And it was both heartening that people wanted to come and a sad reflection of how difficult it is for some carers and their loved ones that despite all the risks of COVID, they still came. Mm-hmm. And there are definitely ways of looking at that story.
Yeah, and I think that's something that many places will look at after this in terms of just the significant increase in caring roles throughout COVID and the pressure that that's put on carers in the longer term. Thanks, Mark. I found that really interesting.
And we didn't get everything right, you know. We've invited guests back for 11 night breaks, and we've invested in a post who does nothing else but spends time with those guests to talk about the experience that they're having. And on a Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, the management and clinical teams sit down together and learn what we can from the experience of the guests that week. And we've made changes every single time we've had that meeting. It's been a really valuable experience for us.
Mark, can I just pick up on that point of the learning and the opportunities that have emerged from the past few months? And I'm just wondering if there are ways that you as an organisation have been able to think differently about the range of services that you have on offer and perhaps engage with the wider local community to see what additional support and assistance they could provide.
Yeah, I often say the thing that I got from my parents is hope and optimism, which my mum says is, yeah, that's why it gets you into trouble so much. Not always a great thing. But the more positive story to tell about the whole COVID experience is that, you know, that phrase, what is it? Mother is the necessity of invention or something like that. I can't remember the phrase. But anyway, we found ourselves with staff with skill, and all of our staff live locally, the entirety of the team, great resources in terms of the building and what we've built up over the time, and this huge need which hadn't gone away. But we started to be able to think more creatively about how we might help people with that need in more imaginative ways. So we started off with, I mentioned we ran a quiz, and Gavin Hastings is a great supporter of the organization. He said, oh, I'll host a quiz. So you've got Gavin and Diane, his wife, sitting in their living room with a gin and tonic, hosting a topical quiz on a Thursday at 11 o'clock in the morning. And it was a lighthearted bit of fun that we didn't think would go very far, but it kept running. And what we discovered was that carers knew at 11 o'clock on a Thursday morning, for an hour, they could fly out the house, go and get a cup of tea, do a bit of ironing, you know, whatever it was they needed to do, because for an hour, their loved one was being entertained and was in full view of 30 or 40 other people. So if anything really terrible happened, there were lots of eyes on there. And so we started to build on that. We started a book club, a virtual book club, and that provided another hour in the week. And then some people wanted just a chat. So we're blessed with 70 volunteers who do something on a regular basis at Lukey. And we got in touch with the volunteers and we set up effectively a pen pal system where volunteers would agree to Zoom call, phone call, email, or old fashioned write a letter. And we managed that process. So it was all GDPR compliant and all the rest of it. So there were lots of ways that guests had the opportunity to keep in touch with somebody. And we had volunteers who were isolated in their own home or shielding, having chats with guests and carers who, as a small family unit, were isolating in the home. And there were some lovely exchanges there. It was absolutely brilliant. And as an extension of that, we started to think about, so I remember I talked at the start of this about that, the dreadful tendering and short interval care. You know, you're tendering for delivering a 15-minute interval of care. And I know that stuff still goes on and my heart goes out to the people who are involved in it. But we started to think about that and wonder whether respite could be offered for an hour or 2 hours, once or twice a week, because we knew how important the quiz time was. And so working with our partners, we've developed this, what we're calling Lukey at Home. And we're going to start supporting volunteers in a managed way to spend an hour in the house of somebody who may or may not be a guest of Lukey, but giving their carer and loved one a break for that hour once a week so they know they can get out. And the other big change was the move into technology. And we started to think about things like, the million things that a carer might do in a day: switch the lights on and off, open and close the curtains, turn the telly on and off, open the door to let someone get through to the loo, turn the tap on, close the toilet seat. There's little things which take a moment, but can add up to an hour or so a day, or 7 hours a week. I mean, that's a whole day a week of time. Sure. And if you can use technology to steal back those little moments of time, wouldn't that be a wonderful thing to do? And because we've been a bit quieter, we've not had our full complement of guests, we've had the opportunity to explore the kind of technology that might help us. And it turns out that there is fantastic off-the-shelf, relatively cheap stuff that you can get in terms of switching technology, voice-activated stuff, with the technology that can operate these environmental controls and settings. And we've been working with the Health and Social Care Partnership and some others to try and stitch it all together, because once again, that's the bit that's missing. So our aspiration is to become, and we would never have thought about this before March, become the National Centre of Excellence for Technology-Enabled Care, because we can fit this stuff throughout the building. Guests can come and see the art of the possible, work out what works for them and have it tailored for them, and then go away with an idea of what technology might actually work for them.
Mark, we started this podcast by talking about the different leadership roles and responsibilities that you've held prior to coming to Lukey. So I was wondering what you've learned about leadership over the last 8 months. What particular leadership skills do you think have been important to see you through these very complex and challenging times?
Yeah, there have been some lessons. And I suppose on one hand, the sort of technical, and on the other hand, they're more about values and emotions, really. So when we were struggling to work out what to do, and there was no plan, you know, there wasn't 25 pages of Gantt charts and numbers and stuff like that, I went back to our articles. And our articles have that sort of flowery language because they're really old, but essentially they say, Lukey exists to improve the lives of people with MS and neurological conditions and their carers by providing a break. So that's pretty simple and straightforward. Our challenge then was, so how do we do it? Let's ignore what we've done for the last 10 years and think again about how we can do it. And that was very powerful, to be able to sit down with a team of people and say, look, we've got this staff, we've got this building, we've got this much cash, and there wasn't very much of that, and it was running out very fast. And this is what we're supposed to do. So how are we going to do it? And we started looking at the little things and paying attention to the detail. So that was the first thing. Big picture and direction of travel in a crisis is much more important than the minutiae, for me anyway. The second one was, we have 80 staff at Lukey, 70 volunteers, and I haven't counted how many people we work with in the wider community. And we mercilessly picked their brains for advice and presented the challenge that we have and asked them if they had any ideas. And we did that a lot. So we had this, rather than one brain at the top traditional hierarchical model, which I've never been very good at, we had at least the intellectual capacity of 200 people. With decades of experience. So we had thousands of years of experience to draw upon. And that was really, really powerful. And you know, it was literally ideas on a post-it on a wall, and the ones that seemed most sensible were the ones we pursued. It was nothing more fantastical than that. And we, I include carers and our guests in that community as well. Their advice was fantastic. And I think the last one was the emotional one, and it's about hope. And it's really easy, and I do too, it's really easy to get bogged down with how dark it all is and will continue to be for quite some time. But hope really gives you strength. And sometimes even when you don't feel that hopeful, I think as a leader, your job is to present hope to those who you work with and just give it a chance to flourish. And in a way, that's probably what Luki is all about and why it feels like such a comfortable fit for me here, because everything about Luki is about hope. It's about making the best of what you've got, enjoying what you have, and looking for opportunities to maximize the joy in every day, really.
Mark, that seems to be an excellent note on which to finish this podcast. So can I just say thank you very much indeed for your time and for sharing your experience. I appreciate we're not quite at the end of the tunnel yet, but there's certainly a light on the horizon, and hopefully it won't be too long before we're all back to some form of normality. But in the meantime, just all the very best to you and the team at Luki.
Well, thanks, Don. Thanks, Kate. It's been sort of cathartic. I feel like I've been through Desert Island Discs without having to choose the music.
We must add that to the next podcast, Kate. We'll make it.
Yeah, we must do. Luxury item. Here we come.
Mark, thanks again. Thank you very much for listening to this podcast. If you'd like further information about Luki House, you can visit their website at lukihouse.org.uk. And if you'd like further information about Shared Care Scotland, then please visit our website, sharedcarescotland.org.uk. And on there, you'll be able to sign up for our latest e-bulletins, as well as connect with our different social media platforms.